Group meeting, Saturday, 17th December, 1988. The latter part of December is, of course, specially concerned with Christmas, which is regarded as the birthday of Jesus Christ. Whether that was actually so, I do not know. It may have been, or it may not have been. But it is the significance of Christmas which is of real importance. Jesus himself, during the course of his ministry, said, "A prophet is not without honor save in his own country and in his own house," when people were offended with what he was teaching them or trying to teach them. What he was really trying, I expect, was to awaken them to the fact of the embodied God within them. You know the statement, "The kingdom of heaven is within you." And the kingdom of heaven, of course, necessarily implies also the God idea as such, and the power, the creative power of the divine. We can imagine what weariness it was to him when his own family and those around him, his own community, more or less rejected him. They thought he was mad, meshwege, to talk in those terms. With hindsight, we can see that he was indeed one of the perfected holy ones whose destiny was to try and awaken man to the full meaning of his manhood and the embodied godhood. When his mother and brother came to look for him in the temple, and they found him teaching there, this little boy of 12, they were very astonished. And the only answer he seems to have given, this is how it is recorded, it may be accurate or it may be nearly accurate, but not telling the whole story. He said, "Who is my mother? Who is my brother?" And looking round at those who were listening to him, he said that "These are my mother and my brother, for they are listening to the word of God." Jesus was supposed to be the son of a carpenter. Now I wonder whether Joseph, his father Joseph, was a real carpenter or not. He may have been a carpenter, but I think there is another significance which we can see in this statement that he was the son of a carpenter. You know how in the Rig Veda, the creation of the universe is ascribed to different gods. Agni, Varuna, Vishvakarman, and so on. Now this last named, Vishvakarman, means the maker, the architect, the carpenter. And in speaking of Jesus as the son of a carpenter, we might, one of the significances might be that he was reconstructing the life of man in the likeness of the divine from which he came. Because Jesus was well acquainted, of course, with the Old Testament. He knew what the prophets taught, and he knew the Torah, and so forth. And that statement in the first chapter of Genesis, Elohim, it is translated as Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. Which I prefer to translate, let us create man in our own living likeness. Of course, I have no linguistic grounds or philological grounds for that translation at all. But that is how it came to me, that it is better to put it that way. Elohim minded, because the mind is that form of that original form of the primordial creative energy which brings forth manifestation. And man is a manifestation. Transcendence itself, or if you like, God himself, is shapeless, formless, but is regarded as the creator of the cosmos which is shaped and formed. What does a carpenter do? He gives shape and form to the wood with which he deals, the material with which he deals. And so, Jesus, himself having realized his oneness with transcendence, he says outright, I and my Father are one, must have had in mind or saw it as his destiny to try and awaken those around him to the true meaning of the creation of man. There were also other folk who followed him sincerely and intelligently and also with insight. They saw that Jesus was what he claimed to be. In the Gospels you get just one outstanding example of that, when Simon Peter says, in answer to Jesus' question, who do you think I am? And he said, thou art the living Christ, the Son of the Blessed. Now, that was a moment of extraordinary vision for Peter. Of course, he was called Peter afterwards, because Jesus said that he would be the rock on which the church and the teachings would be built. Petrus is a rock, but Peter, I'm afraid, got petrified. That was the difficulty with Peter. He saw it, he visualized it in terms of making images and building temples and so on, of crystallizing, concretizing that which could not be concretized, but which could only be realized through that spiritual insight which comes with the perfecting of the psyche and the body. So Jesus turns round upon him, upon Simon, and says, "Get thee behind me, for thou art Satan." I have called Judas in this book the son of doom, because Judas was the instrument, finally, which led to the crucifixion, as you all know. But let us inquire, would the Son of God have triumphed, as indeed he has triumphed, but for the son of doom? What was the significance of that crucifixion? The crucifix, the cross, is the upright and the other piece at right angles to it. It is the descent into matter of the spirit itself. The creative spirit, the creative energy, which gives rise to the whole evolutionary process by which a universe comes into being and man himself comes into being. But in that process, duality comes into existence. In the process of the manifestation of the universe, there had to be at least duality, which also ultimately becomes multiplicity. The duality essentially of positive and negative, of male and female, of good and evil. Now it is necessary for us to, if we are to appreciate what Jesus attempted to do, to understand what was regarded as evil. The feminine side, the negative aspect of creative energy, has the tendency to fixate what actually is, because this spells security, material security, as well as, to a considerable extent, psychological security. What does the wife, the mother, look for? The home in which there will be shelter, in which the children can be brought up, and so on. The man goes out a hunting, a collecting food, and so on, earning the livelihood. But that which stabilizes, which fixates things, is the feminine element. When you get a female who does not fixate things, you get a suffragette. and so on. You get the more or less creative type. So now, it was this fixation which was regarded as evil, partly and considerably due to the influence of Plato. Because Plato was acquainted, well acquainted, with the secret doctrines. And it was seen that where fixation was concerned, and where material establishment was concerned, the positive and negative together had become stabilized, fixed. In terms of the man-wife relationship, as marriage until death do us part. In terms of physical things, the hut, the house, the palace, whatever it was, it's a fixture. And it is that which prevents the creative side, the creative spirit, from producing that which is new. Jesus, as the perfected Holy One, knew that transcendence itself is ceaselessly creative, engaged in creative action in eternity, which is always new. Its variety is infinity, and it is in that sense primarily that God is called the infinite, the not limited. Jesus knew that. And he tried in his way to help the Jews to get out of this idea of the feminine and the negative side as the evil side. Because once you have anything fixed, especially in the realm of ideas, then you cannot grow out. You cannot grow out of them. They become fixations in the name of which, as you know in history, terrible wars and frightful cruelties have been practiced. The good, that which is the good, is that which is always new. In manifestation, if we can bring that about, to correspond with the infinitude of creative action by transcendence itself, then that which is the manifested world will become also the good world. Then only the manifested universe will be itself the kingdom of heaven established. Not so much established as freely functioning, because what is established gets fixed. It is this kind of spiritual freedom which the perfected Holy Ones have tried to present to mankind, because they knew that each person is quite unique, and that uniqueness has to be expressed through that freedom and through that endless variety of function and manifestation. But of course, the Jews wouldn't have it. This son of the carpenter, the son of Vishwakarman. That which makes constantly anew the creative renewal which goes on perpetually. This son of the carpenter, when he confessed to Caiaphas, when Caiaphas asked him, "Art thou the son of the blessed?" Jesus said, "Yes, I am." Then that was the supreme blasphemy, because that meant that the conception they had, which of course really is a misconception, that Yahweh is the one and only male Yahweh. If he had a son, he must of necessity have a wife, and he must have a child. And yet it is curious that Christendom, this again was partly through the influence of Plato. Plato had a dualistic influence on history. When he traveled after the murder of Socrates, when he went to Egypt and brought back Egyptian wisdom to the Greeks, the concept of Isis, Osiris, Horus. See, there was the female in between. Osiris, Isis, Horus. There was the female between the other two males. And then again, there arose the concept of the Father, the Virgin Mary, and Jesus Christ. Because Christ was the son of the Virgin Mary. There is a word in the English language which I have forgotten. I wonder if any of you know it. You know, it happens in the plant kingdom. Pregnancy takes place without any sex. It's called something conception. The Roman Catholic Church, of course, have talked of the Immaculate Conception. But the scientists have a special word for this. And for the life of me, I can't remember it.
Parthenogenesis.
Yeah. That's it. Thank you. Yes. Is it in the dictionary? I think it must be.
I think it should be in a good dictionary.
Yes. Well, I looked up conception and reproduction, but I couldn't find parthenogenesis. Yes. This parthenogenetic conception of Jesus, the Roman Catholic Church put it as Immaculate Conception. But little did the Church realize that they spoke very truly there, because a virgin birth takes place when the individual himself, through the complete purification of the psyche and the whole of the mind, the psychophysical organism as a whole is completely purified. Then the spirit of the divine takes birth there in that person. He is the true mystic. I think that it was that sort of thing which enabled Eckhart to state in that Ascension Day sermon of his called Hindrances that man verily is God and God verily is man. Because when that realization comes to fruition in the consciousness of the purified, perfected Holy One, then that is the birth of God in him. He is the Son of God. This was called in India being the Brahma Putra, the son of Brahma. Brahma, the first person of the Trinity, is the Creator God. and parthenogenetic birth is attributed to Lao Tzu, to Zarathustra, some say to Plato, to Krishna, not our Krishnamurti. And to Jesus. And to the Buddha too. It's very interesting that this virgin birth is ascribed to all of them. You know, the Buddha is said to have emerged out of the right side of his mother, Mahamaya, as she was standing in that grove. Is it known whether any mother does give birth in the standing position?
Oh, yes, I'm sure it must be, yes.
And it is known.
Give birth underwater today, yes, certainly it must be known. And yeah. In a crouching position as well.
Yes.
African women do.
African women, yes, I was just thinking African women do. Anyhow, that is ascribed to the mother of the Buddha, you see, and they consider it as a virgin birth. But I think that the true meaning of virgin birth, immaculate conception and virgin birth, is simply that the man himself, the woman herself, through that development which leads to her his or her complete purification, the divine energy begins to function through her freely. That is the virgin birth. Because there is no concupiscence involved in this unification of the human with the transcendent. You know that especially the great women mystics, not only of the Catholic world, but also of the Islamic world. There was a case of Rabia, a most wonderful mystic. But it is especially noticeable in the case of the women mystics of the Catholic world, that they talked of their union with the divine in terms of the union of the male and the female, which is true literally in a transcendent sense, because the positive aspect of creative energy in complete harmony with the negative aspect of creative energy enables the mystic to teach and represent in his actual life what he does teach. See. So now, the teaching which Jesus gives is, of course, essentially the Sermon on the Mount. Now, this mount do you really think that he climbed up a hill and spoke to all those people on the hill? As a physical fact, in the days when I had to speak for the Ministry of Information to the troops, there were two occasions on which I had to speak to the American troops. And there were 10,000 of them, all covering a hillside. And I had to go up to the top and speak to them from the top of the hill about Indian culture and history and that sort of thing, you see. It is possible. And strangely enough, I had a terrific voice in those days. And everyone heard every word. And they were astonished. How do you do it? I said, I don't know how I do it, but it happens like that. There were two such occasions. Now, the mount. This mount comes in all the religious teachings. In the Zarathustrian, we have Ushidarena as the mount of the Lord. In Hindu teaching, we have Mount Meru, you see, and so on. There is this mount. Now, what exactly is this mount in terms of the religious life, the life of the yogi? It is the Sahasrara Chakra, the top of the head, where it is said that Vishnu resides, Shiva resides. That's my talking clock. Shiva resides there. But Shiva waits until the person, the would-be yogi, has undergone the whole sequence of purification and development by which Shakti, the transcendent energy which lies within himself, climbs up the spinal cord and meets her Lord. Again, that is the female energy, the serpent fire, and meets her Lord at the top of the in the brain where Shiva resides. This is the mount. All the great teachers, all the true spiritual teachers, when they are in that exalted condition, they speak from a level of consciousness which I call holistic consciousness. When Shiva and Shakti are united. And this is the ascent to the mount. It is also the meaning of the ascension after the crucifixion. But I won't deal with that now, because otherwise I'll go on too long. It is from that level that he speaks. It is from that level that the Buddha used to speak. He says so outright in one of the discourses. It's in the first volume of the Majjhima Nikaya. So, speaking from the mount, the Sermon on the Mount comes from there. And it is couched in simple words, as you know, but those simple words have not merely simple meanings. Take, for instance, the statement, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Now, the Gospels were written in Greek. He spoke in Aramaic, and that Aramaic was translated into Greek. And the Greek word used for meek is a word which is used, which was used in connection with their dealings with a colt, a fresh colt, who had not been tamed. The word is praos, pi, rho, omicron, alpha, sigma, praos, praos, praos. Now, praos for the Greeks meant in practice just this: when a young colt was taken, he was tamed first and he was trained afterwards. Now, this taming and training is the meaning of the word praos. Jesus used the word meek. What happens with the taming and training of the colt? The colt no longer kicks his hind legs and knocks your head off or something. He's a meek He is meeked. And the Christian mystics have used that word, meeked, M-E-E-K-E-D, very consistently. So this is the meaning. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the tamed and the trained, for they shall inherit the earth. And of course, the Francis Drakes and such like think of empire building. Nothing of the sort. The earth, in religious parlance, is this, the psychophysical organism. You'll find it again and again used in the Upanishads, and more than earth, they have used the word the worlds. And they use the word worlds in two ways, one to represent the organism, and one to represent the different states of consciousness as consciousness evolves. You see? So, the Sermon on the Mount has to be interpreted in the light of the knowledge of the mystics and the yogis. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. When you inherit the earth, then there is your capital, like the capital bequeathed by your rich father to you. There is the capital which you have to use in such a manner that you realize the perfection of manhood, of being a human being. And that, when that happens, then those words of Jesus, and the manhood was taken into the Godhead, come true. Take another meaning. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Who are the peacemakers? Yasser Arafat and Mr. Schultz? No. Each one of us has to be the peacemaker. Within us is that duality of positive and negative, of male and female, of good and evil. And there is this constant struggle going on. What one desires along the lines which will release the true human, or along lines which degrades the human and makes him bestial. You see. Now this male and female in us, the animus and the female body, the anima and the male body, the masculine and the feminine in us, has to be unified, harmonized. And when that is harmonized, the first meaning of the marriage made in heaven has taken place. You see, the whole of religion refers to us individually, to us personally. It tells us the story of our own growth and development and coming to fulfillment. So, when this peace has been made within us, the conflicting elements in our own psyche and in our bodily life, when those two have become harmonized, then there is peace established. And when that is established, we are inevitably, invariably, naturally, and spontaneously the peacemakers in our environment. It spreads to our environment. So you see, one of the tremendous tasks of the yogi is to establish this peace. Jesus certainly was a yogi, in the real sense of the word. It is a yogi who can perform miracles and so forth. And a yogi in the true sense, in the great sense, not the self-advertising ones in the magazines and so on, a yogi is capable of performing miracles because he is capable of functioning consciously in terms of the infinite and the eternal. And in the infinite eternal, there is no disharmony. There is no disorder. There is only purity, harmony, beauty, order. So, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will inherit the earth. And in this inheritance, this becomes the living God on earth. You know, in the golden verses of Pythagoras, one of the last, I think it is the last verse, it is said that when you have gone past all the trouble and conflict of the body as such, then you will be like a God, immortal. Immortal, not in terms of a physical immortality, because that which is manifested physically must of necessity pass away, because it undergoes those changes which lead to decay and death inevitably. But you experience the meaning of immortality in your own consciousness, the meaning of and the actuality of being conscious in terms of the infinite and the eternal. So you see, there is all this involved in those beatitudes of Jesus. One of the greatest, one of the most wonderful teachers that the world saw. And it rests with people like ourselves to investigate these things. Not just intellectually, but investigate them through meditation in the real sense. Meditation which is not just a verbal ritual. Because all the laid down meditative systems are only verbal rituals, just like the mass, the performance of the mass in a Christian church, or the performance of a jasan in the Zarathustrian temple, or the Hindu or the Buddhist prayers and this, that and that. They're all verbal rituals. But are they something which express your innermost consciousness? Your innermost consciousness is that which has no conflict whatever, no ill whatever. It is healthy. It is whole. It is holy. That's the meaning of those words. Health, wholeness, holiness. They are one and the same thing. And this is yoga, in the real sense. Psychophysically, pleasure and pain are both present and will remain present throughout our life, because that is the nature of psychophysical existence. There will be sorrow, there will be grief, there will be pleasure, there will be joy. There will be also ecstasy and enstasy. All the duals will naturally manifest, but it is a case of responding in the right way to them, not reacting to them. And this is where the great training of the yogi comes in. The Buddha said Samma Sati and Samma Samadhi. Jesus said watch and pray. This constant watchfulness which enables your consciousness never to reject anything, never to reject it, be awake to it, be conscious of it, but you're free from reacting to it. When you're free from reacting to it, then you're in harmony, in unity with it, whatever it be, God or the devil, angel or a horrible creature or anything, it doesn't matter. You are in unity with it. You're in harmony with it. And in that state, you can always respond in the right way, the human way. And that means heaven on earth, and it means peace in the world. Thank you.